Accession number 9552, reel 10.
Mr. Basil Farrer, Reel 10. Could you tell me how you were kept supplied with munitions, the ammunition, and while you were in the trenches at this time?
Well, in the first place, the equipment that we had, the old regular army equipment of the 1914 war, were five pouches on each side, fitted onto the equipment, and each pouch were three class of cartridges, that is to say five. He'd have 100, therefore he'd have 15 in each little pocket, and there were five pockets that made 75 on one side and 75 on the other. He'd have 100 rounds of ammunition. Now if perchance he had to, there was an attack, or he found himself having to shoot off, well, there'd be, we'd take up boxes of ammunition. There'd be boxes of ammunition supplies in boxes. But whilst all in the trenches, you rarely had occasion to do any shooting. Particularly at that time when I joined, it was the winter, and it was a question of just being there. It was almost a live and let live. I mean, if you didn't bother him, he wouldn't bother you. But nevertheless, we had to show some activity. And if our artillery started shelling, it doesn't mean he's shelling their artillery, it's shelling the front-line trench. Well, their artillery would reply.
What about equipment or your uniform? Did they stand up to the pressures of trench life well, or did they wear out?
Oh, they stood up fairly well, but in that winter of 15 and 16, I remember it was particularly rigorous, cold, snowy, and we were issued with some with sheepskin jerkins, some with leather jerkins. I had a leather jerkin. A jerkin is a kind of a sleeveless coat which doesn't fasten, you pass it over your head, very much like a medieval thing. You add that to keep you warm. And as I said, I wasn't involved, you see. I was an infantryman, but having become a stretcher bearer, I more or less ignored what went on with the infantryman himself, with my friends. I mean, now they got the. But I'm just speaking logically.
What about the uniform? How did that stand up to the mud and the wet? Would you have to have it replaced regularly, or would you just basically keep the same one for month on end?
Oh, keep the same one month on end until it's... unless, of course, it was torn. If you'd been out in no man's land and got caught on barbed wire, well, you'd probably rip your trousers. And when you... After your turn, you'd have to continue with that. There's no change of anything in the front line with regard to clothing. But when you relief, as I say, 5 days in, you're 5 days out, then you'd report to see the quartermaster and get something new.
Would you be responsible for minor repairs to the uniform yourself if you've got a little nicked?
Oh, yes. Yes, because I think, now what the dickens, I think it was, I've forgotten what it was called, in the initial issue, but in pre-war, soldiers were issued with a little thing, I don't know whether it's called a soldier's comforter, with the... a needle, cotton and things like that, and obviously you would be expected to do minor repairs, and I've forgotten whether we took that with us. It was a part of our equipment, because in peacetime you were responsible for your you had to do.
I'd like now to look at various aspects of health and sanitation, so to speak, in the front line. The first one was there any sort of way you could wash, even just basically hands and face? Was there any water or anything provided so you could wash while you were in the front line?
No. In the first place, you were in for 5 days. Well, chaps would shave. Safety razors were rare, so it was the old cutthroat. And you remember Bain's father's cartoon, you shave in a chap, and he said, "Keep still, or cut your bloody head, cut your bloody throat." And shells were flying over, you know, and he could be killed at any moment. Anyhow, we had the old cutthroat razor, And some chaps would probably save a little drop of warm tea to get the lather, you know. But as I was young at the time, I don't remember I was troubled much with that. I don't remember. I must have shaved, but I don't think I needed much of a shave. I must have shaved. Obviously, I must have done.
But you do without washing, there'd be no...
Oh, there's no question of that in the front line trench.
What about latrines? What latrine arrangements?
Well, in certain parts, just at the back, there'd be a little sort of alley made behind the trench itself, a little trench, into another little open latrine there, and then a hole in the ground. And there was a period when the question of hygiene in the front line became very serious to the effect. And I remember, on one occasion, it was very unfortunate, with regard to urinating in the trench, it became a crime, and you were punished. And I remember we were being relieved one night, and I remember the chap's name, strange to say, Costello. He was in front, and as he was walking along, he was urinating. The officer spotted him and put him on a charge as he was walking up the trench because of this strict order on account of hygiene. So we had to use these field things out of the line. Of course, there were field latrines made, and disinfectant put in, and all that kind of stuff. But in the front line, it was just a little thing, a little small trench out of the front line trench to a space behind.
Was it just a hole in the ground? Any sort of wooden bench or anything
on? Not to my recollection, but that would have been futile because, I mean, stuff coming over and it had just been chucked up in the air.
What about paper? Did this apply things like paper?
No.
So what would the soldier do?
Well, in any bit of paper he had, he'd make sure of a bit of ordinary paper. If you had any, it's all the newspaper, anything.
Were they a particularly dangerous place, the latrines? For instance, did snipers?
Yes, I've known a chap to be doing his job there and to be hit. Because probably, the location, I mean, you didn't know what Jerry could see, but invariably he was better placed, especially on the Somme, he was always better placed than us. He overlooked us, in other words. He overlooked all our positions. And if a latrine was so placed and a sniper spotted it, he'd be ready for anybody sitting, going there, squatting down. And I have known a casualty there. I have a recollection of a casualty there.
What about other waste disposal? I'm thinking of things like cans, because you'd obviously have a lot of empty tin cans from the food you were issued. How would that be disposed of in the front line?
Really, I'll be perfectly honest, it had to be disposed of. The method, I have no clear recollection. The logical thing is we must have put them in sacks, you know, sandbag sacks to be taken out and buried. Otherwise, the place would become clustered with tins and what will you, which would be very bad. But I must honestly say I have forgotten what arrangements were made. I can only speak what logically would be the case.
What about lice? I believe there were quite
lice. Well, you doubt any. I don't know about the officers, but any, because they had occasion to bath more regularly than we did, and they had servants and all that, and they had mobile canvas things, and especially when they were out of the line. But the soldier, once he hadn't been in the front line very long before he became lousy, and he was lousy then for the rest of the war practically. When we went out occasionally back for baths, we'd be issued with clean shirts, but very quickly lousy. And they were one of the greatest annoyances. Chaps would take off the shirt and with a cigarette burning all this, and the trousers seams, they got in all the seams of the trousers, and they were really one of the nasty things.
In what way were they actually irritating? Just the moving about, or did they bite, or...?
I don't remember them biting, but they must have been, because some of them were big and used to kill them, and they'd be full of blood. So they must have been getting somewhere or other. Them and rats. Well, rats, truthfully, I've seen them, they couldn't run. You could just walk up to them and stick them in the bin. They're so fat. And they had plenty to eat. That was one of the looking back now, perhaps it's only my imagination now, but was a because that is a soldier's fear, not of being killed. He knows perfectly well he can be killed at any moment. His fear is to have a nasty wound. His hope is a blighty, a nice clean blighty. But in attack, to be out in no man's land, immobilised perhaps, and then these rats crawling around. That was that was one of my fears. And you'd be in your dugout, you'd have your food, some bread and even cheese, and to the roof of the dugout there might be a timber, and you'd have your haversack hung on that with your food in to protect it, and the rats would still get it. But whilst you were trying to sleep or asleep, you'd feel them and you could just brush them off like you would anything. You got so used to it. But they're nasty things, rats, big ones. I've never seen such big ones.
Did you used to try and kill them, or did you pretty much let them get on with it? I mean, would you actually?
Oh, if
they were
in the trench, chaps would put the bayonet through them and then sling them over the side. But otherwise, I mean, they were running freely. The areas were mostly rat infested.
What about other sorts of pests? In the early summer, would you get flies in the summer area? Flies or maggots or mice or the rodents?
No, I don't. I honestly don't. I don't recollect anything like that.
Said Carnoir was a quiet sector. Did you have many dead bodies marooned in no man's land or built into the trenches or
shallow
buried?
I think it was on the trench going up from Carnoir where there was an arm protruding, which we used to shake every time we went by. Cheerio, chum, as we went by. I think it was that area, because I remember that long trench from the bottom of the hill where there was a derelict building where this cow was, and that was where the regimental aid post was, and I think regimental headquarters at the bottom of that trench. But in no man's land in front, where there were no dead bodies that had been cleared.
So you used to shake hands with this?
Well, you know, I remember vaguely. I honestly can't understand. When I'm looking back, I can't understand how the hand held. You'd have thought the skeleton and the bones would fall off. But I do remember, and it couldn't have been for very long. But I have been in trenches where you felt, hello, there's a body under here. And on one occasion...
How could you tell?
Well, the ground give way soft, and prompts you smell it, because there's a nasty smell, nasty, sweet smell. It's a dead body. And I remember perfectly well, and of course now I'm jumping forward, it was during the Somme battle, as a matter of fact, which seemed, speaking of feeding trench, we were in the trenches overlooking the front line where we were going to go that night, and the exact spot where I was, and there were some other chaps there, they said, there's a body here. And they did a good job. And it was a German. They went through his pockets, found some photographs, and then just threw him on the top. I mean, Travis.
It sounds if you had become acclimatised.
You did. At the very beginning, especially as a very young boy, it was pretty hard. But then you do become acclimatised. There's a harder word than acclimatised to violence. You really get to see nasty things. Obviously, you do fellas with heads off or your arms flying about and all things like that.
What about the effects of you said it was cold and wet in the winter of 1516.
It was indeed.
What effects did that have? Could you tell me how it affected your life in the French front line?
Well, as far as... I, as a stretcher bearer, but as I know that the chaps, they're different in with the rifle. You know, it's so cold, and the rifle the hands get so cold. But apart from that, well covered up, and during that month, there was no actual combat. There was an occasional shot over the top, a sniper's bullet or a shell, or things like that.
Did any of the ailments that sort of arise from cold and wet conditions come out? Like, I'm thinking of things like frostbite.
Frostbite, yes. Lots of soldiers at the beginning, lots of soldiers eventually became frostbitten. And it was so, it became, now I'm speaking not from personal experience, only what I heard at the time, and was told, see, by the, we were told, it became so prevalent, this frost bite, the feet, because you were stood in icy cold water all for 24 hours a day for four days and four nights. You'd have, I mean, the snow and ice, it is extraordinary what the human body. Now, I've only got to be in a draft to get a cold. There, you could be up to your knees in ice for 5 days and five nights and lay in it. And you didn't. Anyhow, there were cases, numerous cases of frostbite. The feet, particularly. Trench feet, that was the name. Trench feet. Not only because of the frost, but also the dampness. You know, trenches are wet. That it became a crime, almost a crime, to have trench feet, because it was the authorities maintained it was your own fault. You should look after your feet. You see, and make sure that they should be greased and everything like that. And in some regiments, you'd be punished for instead of being sent out. That I'd heard, but it
did you look after your feet? Did you take any care of
it? I don't remember doing so. No, no. I had good strong ammunition boots, you know, and we had putties in those days, not what they had in the Second World War, putties. And they lapped around they gave you a certain amount of protection. But they got wet through, that was the trouble. And then when we came out, we hung them up and dry them and our clothes too.
What about what they call trench fever? Is there any signs of that?
I don't remember coming across it, trench fever.
How about dysentery or any other?
Or even dysentery. I don't remember that. Not in France. When I say not in France, not in any where I was at different periods.
What was your overall personal health like? Just yourself. What was your health like during that winter and then on into early summer of 16?
Well, remarkable. I was fit right through. I never reported sick. Only once. And it was before the 1st of July, in that sector, I must have caught a bad cold, I was a bit delirious, I was in the regiment aid post, evacuated to the casualty clearing station, and all chaps milling round, and I felt better when I got there. I thought, well, I'd better get back as quick as I can, because in the first place, as I told you, I'd volunteered from a non-combatant corps to an infantry, but when I saw what actually happened, I'd been a bit scared of being an actual using rifle and bayonet and things like that, and I had a dangerous job. Regiment stretcher bearers is one of the quite dangerous, because whereas your pals, when if they're attacking, they dig in if they get there, you're on the top, as I've said before. But nevertheless, I left the casualty clearing station and walked back the next day and took on my job. That was the only time I remember reporting sick. The only time, as far as I can remember. During the whole of that war, I don't remember any other period. And that was only for 24 hours. I was a bit delirious, I don't know why.
I'd like now to look at the daily routine, starting, if we can, with stand two in the morning. What would you do as a stretcher bearer during morning stand two?
Well, each company had two stretcher bearers. Two stretchers, rather, four stretcher bearers to each company. And when the company stand two in the morning, every man in his post there, stand two, I've forgotten what hours it would be, that is was a regular thing, because one generally attacked in the early morning, so stand two ready for any attack. And in the winter, that was when you got your rum ration. In the winter, and the company officer would be there, and the rum you had your canteen.
You told us that, yes, yeah. Last time. Yeah.
And just a couple of spoonfuls of rum. Well, I've forgotten. You stood too, and I've forgotten the procedure after.
Would you have your stretcher with you when you were at this time? Would you normally have your stretcher nearby?
If we didn't, it would certainly be nearby. As when the soldier stood to, he stood to with his arm, with his rifle and everything. As a matter of fact, in the front trench, line trench, the soldier was never without his rifle. He slept with it and was always there. And of course, his equipment on. He was not allowed to take his equipment off. He'd undo the belt and in the dugout and small hole in the ground, undo the belt so as to loosen it, but he was not allowed to take his things off in the front line. That was, and even in reserve, we weren't supposed to take all our clothes off.
What after stand two, what would you do during the day? What would be the sort of normal daytime routine for you as a stretcher bearer, roughly speaking?
Absolutely nothing at all. Nothing, stretcher bearer. We'd be in the front line. In our the company stretcher bearers would generally share have a dugout to themselves there with our stretchers, and we'd be available on call for if there was a casualty. The words passed down the line: stretcher bearer, stretcher bearer.
And then what?
And then of course we'd go along with our stretcher, attend to the man, see if he was wounded, if he was sufficiently, we could apply his personal. Every soldier had a in a pocket in his tunic in the inside. A dressing. Well, we'd get that out, and there's always and the only and there's a little phial of iodine. If the wound wasn't too serious, we'd get that out and put the iodine on, and just lap it up, and then put him on the stretcher and take him down to the regiment lead post, where he'd be dealt with by the MO attached to the battalion. Every infantry battalion had an RMC, a medical officer attached, who had a in normal things like that had very little to do except in attacks, and then of course it was night and day work and quite a lot to do.
Was it difficult carrying the stretcher down the communication trenches?
It was in some way. You had to lift it high, you couldn't get it round corners, and it was sometimes very difficult to get round corners and there were very often fairly deep the communication trenches, deeper than the sometimes the front line trench. And it was particularly awkward very often to get them round the corners.
So you'd lift them high up?
You'd lift them as well as you could and gradually work it round. Yes.
Is there anything you can tell me to indicate how casualties would behave while you were tending them and carrying them back? Was there a common pattern or uncommon pattern?
Frankly, I couldn't. With any, I can't remember that. Naturally, it would all depend upon the gravity of his wound. If he was wounded in such a painful way that any movement, he'd yell out, obviously, and you'd try not to hurt him. But the thing was to get him out. And it's surprising what men could put up with. Really, I've seen during battle where men have been crawling on the knees with a foot off, crawling down the trench with a foot off, because stretcher bearers would be occupied. And then again, that's another thing. In attack, you look after your own wounded. As you'll pass, there'll be a man called to you, stretcher bearer. You'd go and look on his shoulder plate, see if he wasn't of your regiment, you were concerned with your pals. And you got used to that. You had to leave the fellow. You left the fellow.
That's interesting.
You were a York stretcher bearer.
Was that an instruction or was that...
No, it wasn't as far as I'm concerned, as far as I can recollect, but it was a natural thing. You know, you'd got plenty of your own. And it was up to his regiment to stretcher bearers. Of course, they may have been killed, because when you mount the parapet, you're just as liable to be killed as... That is why they were always renewing the stretcher bearers, and that's how I got the job. They'd just lost one.
What about the ones who were less badly wounded? Were they really pleased to get a blighty one?
Oh, my... That was invariable. Of the ordinary soldier, there might have been some heroes, every... and all that kind of thing. And when you've been in in that war, you very soon had enough of the heroics, and it was always the hope for a blight. You'd be going into battle... you'd be going up, the battle would be some 100 yards in front, and the wounded would be coming back. fellas would be coming back covered with blood, their arms in a sling, and you'd envy them, you lucky buggers. That would be the expression.
Was that real envy, or was that...
Real envy. A blighty was the only thing. A chap knew it could happen any moment. It could happen any moment in the front line. And the thing was, it wasn't the fear... I don't think, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I can remember, it wasn't the fear of death. You knew that you were there to... That was your job. It was a nasty death you feared, and that you hoped if it came clean out, and if it was a blighty, that was lovely.
So during the day in the trench, you'd be awaiting the call. What would you actually do then while you were waiting? How would you pass the day? What would you do?
Playing cards, invariably playing cards, or if you'd anything to read, or writing a letter if you'd a letter to write, or reading if you'd anything to read.
Would you talk a lot amongst each other, yourselves?
Yeah, in a natural way. I forgot on any subject where there's always something to talk about. But you wouldn't sit there all on your own and daydream that, or no. You'd find something to do, either somebody to talk to, or you'd wander up and just in, up and down the trench and talk with the chaps there.
Was there a limit on the number of people who could be in a bay? Or at any one time?
Well, according to the strength of the company, there'd be one or two posters. You wouldn't fill the bay.
No, I mean for fear of a shell catching too
many. That's what I was just going to add. You wouldn't fill the bay because if a shell fell. So there might only be one or two. But I don't remember whether there was any specific instructions as to the number that should be. But obviously, if the enemy attacked, then, of course, every man would be on the fire step.
Was it boring at all? It sounds pretty dull in the sense of what you did all day. There doesn't seem to be much variety.
Well, you got used to it. You could, looking back, you might think, oh, it must have been boring, but I think I don't think you ever felt bored. I don't remember feeling bored. I honestly don't. I may have been bored, but I don't remember. The only thing is, you knew that you were there, stuck there, and you got to put up. Put up with the conditions and what may happen, and pass the time. The troops might, the chaps themselves, there'd be the fellas on the fire step, and then others might have be detailed for strengthening. There might have been the trench, some duck boards being smashed. Well, they'd have sent a fatigue party down to bring up duck boards of the communication trench, or sandbags and odds and ends, but not there was not much activity to my recollection in the front line.
Would you sleep at all during the day?
Those that had nothing to do would very often lay down because they knew perfectly well they may be on duty at night time. So if you're not on duty, if you've nothing to do, you'd go and lay in the dugout, and if you had a dugout,